My husband James and I live on a street that is very friendly. It's kind of a narrow street in North Berkeley with big trees, and neighbors get together, and sometimes the street gets blocked off, and we have potlucks in the street and that kind of thing. And one of my neighbors, Eleanor, is 98 years old, and she's lived alone for about the past 15 years because her husband died and she wanted to stay in her house. And she's checked in, people check in on her every day. Her son comes by occasionally and the neighbors check in on her. And she still drives and goes to the grocery store and she still goes to Mass and she's active with her church group. And every night she climbs the stairs to her second story. Actually, she climbs in twice because she likes to take a nap in the afternoon, too. And she's slept up there for over 70 years. So she feels good about it. And I was walking her home one night, and I said, "Well, how do you keep going with such cheerfulness?" And she said to me, "Honey, it's all about good habits." So I want to talk to you tonight about one of those good habits, which is the habit of forgiveness, which is really timely in terms of this year, of the Jewish New Year coming up, but it's also just really could be applicable any time of the year. And it seems an important thing to talk about because forgiveness is really a resilience and happiness intervention. There's no way really to sit fully in the presence with any kind of love if we're carrying around some story of how someone did us wrong, or we think we've been treated in a way that or that makes us unlovable, or we think we're fundamentally flawed, or any kind of thing about that will keep us sort of locked in. And we may think forgiveness is about the past or about someone else, but forgiveness is fundamentally about ourselves here in the present, because we really forgive for our own peace of mind. In Buddhist teachings, holding a grudge has been compared to drinking poison and hoping the other person will die, or holding on to a hot burning coal to throw at another and expecting the other person to suffer rather than us. So the research really confirms that forgiveness is good for us. It's good for our health, it's good for our relationships with others, and most fundamentally, it's good for our relationship with ourselves. So I want to talk tonight about sort of the steps to forgiveness. And first comes the recognition that suffering is universal. We come from this individualistic, competitive culture, and there's an underlying belief that if we do things right in life, we won't suffer. And the corollary to that is if we're suffering, we must have done something wrong. I spent a number of years working with the women at the Women's Cancer Resource Center, which is a really great center in Oakland. And it serves about 4,000 women a year. Anyone's eligible. They never charge any money for it. They serve a lot of women of color. They serve a very wide range of women. And I got involved with mindful self-compassion, and so I wanted to practice teaching it and just learn as much as I could. So I taught 5 rounds of 8-week classes there as a volunteer. So they didn't pay me, and I didn't get paid anything. They didn't have to pay. It was just a great way to learn for me. And one thing that was really painful was that I was working with women who had become sick. They had lost their health. They had oftentimes had to give up their job, so they gave up their income. The cancer was very impactful for them, and it changed their body, it changed how they felt about their body, and there was this undercurrent that they were somehow flawed and wrong because this happened to them. That if they had only done things right, anything from eating more broccoli or whatever, you know, that then they wouldn't be suffering like this. And of course, that's really a myth. We know if we were walking around 200 or 300 years ago, it would be obvious that everyone suffers. If you have a body, and of course, the Buddha taught, if you're lucky enough to get to old age, you will still face old age, sickness, and death, and you will be separated from all your loved ones. This is just the fact of life. And yet, we somehow believe or pretend that if we just do it right, we won't suffer. So that's a really important thing just to address for ourselves, that suffering is part of life. All beings suffer. And so when we recognize the universality of this pain, we experience some ease and some perspective. I spent decades disturbed by things that I considered unfair, both in the world at large and in my personal life. And this would cause me a lot of distress. It was difficult for me to forgive life because I had this underlying belief that things should happen according to the principles of equality and justice. And finally, I really got it that life is totally unfair. I mean, what really is fair about the fact that I can walk into a grocery store and just sort of pick what I want to eat, and another parent is wrestling with the decision of which child to feed? Or what's fair about the fact that I prefer to drink filtered water and somebody else has to walk for kilometers carrying a jug of semi-polluted water back to their family to have drinking water? So letting go of the notion that I expect fairness, of course I would like fairness, but that I expect in any way that the world will be fair, has also been a huge relief to me. But acceptance of conditions doesn't require any agreement with them. Hopefully, we would still work for justice, but we can't really make changes until we first accept the truth of what's right in front of us with our eyes wide open. So the acceptance doesn't mean passivity. It actually frees up energy to get on with what's important with life. And a number of you, I'm sure, are familiar with Bhikkhu Bodhi's work. He's the premier translator of the Buddhist texts, but he's also the founder of the Buddhist Global Relief, which works to create long-term solutions for ending poverty and hunger while providing education and working for economic justice. So sometimes we think that if we can only arrange the right conditions, then we'll be happy. Like maybe if I play by the rules, I'm really disciplined, I meditate more, maybe I practice awakening joy a little more, and I don't watch the news at night, then I won't suffer. So we can make intentions and do our part to bring about health and love and friendship and justice, and we don't control life. In fact, I'm sure you know people who might be beautiful, smart, accomplished, rich, have wonderful friends and family, and yet they also suffer. So forgiveness is a process. It's not a one-shot deal. Rather than expecting ourselves to immediately forgive, and that's one of those myths that spiritual people just forgive, it doesn't happen immediately just because we wish it would. In fact, there are many people who are suffering with trauma or traumatic events that have happened in their lives, and they think they should forgive, but they really can't. And that's understandable when things have happened that are so devastating. And so then it's more about just honoring the fact that you wish you could forgive, and you'll try to let go a little bit just because it's better for your own health. But there shouldn't be any timetable or any push on top of all the trauma that's already been suffered to say, oh, and now on top of that, I have to forgive as well. So we can begin by just cultivating the intention to someday possibly forgive. Like, may I begin to forgive myself for what I did wittingly or unwittingly to cause another pain? Or may I begin to forgive another for what they did wittingly or unwittingly to cause me pain? So it's really best when forgiveness can become a daily, lifelong practice, a habit. So it's suggested to practice in little ways with small frustrations throughout the day. That's sort of to build up the forgiveness muscle and for dealing with the really hard stuff. And this also just makes for a more nourishing life. So in that sense, forgiveness can become a practice that's almost independent of the particular suffering that we're dealing with. It's kind of similar to a gratitude practice. You can be grateful for certain things like the sunset or the trees or the light on the leaves or whatever. You can also just practice forgiving life or forgiving others or forgiving yourself just in little ways as life goes on. But it actually begins with making a commitment to yourself to do what you have to do to feel better. Because, as I said, forgiveness is mainly for you. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who's the architect of the healing process in the Union of South Africa, puts it this way: forgiveness is the highest form of self-interest. I need to forgive so that my anger and lust for revenge does not corrode my own being. So, as meditators, we often use sort of a primarily solitary process to investigate all the joys and the sorrows of being alive. But if we find ourselves continuing to be stuck and unable to forgive, then the grieving shouldn't be kept to ourselves. As the research shows that the human connection is central to healing, and it's important to share the problem or the situation with a few caring select people, like a really close friend or a therapist, or it doesn't have to be a lot of friends, but just people that will really hear you and support you. Now, I want to just review a little bit about what forgiveness is and what it's not. It's really not condoning, pardoning, forgetting, false reconciliation, appeasement, or sentimentality. It doesn't mean we ever even have to see the person again who betrayed us. Forgiveness really is the inner peace and the wise perspective that allows us to live in the present with love. It allows us to keep our hearts open, even when we face hostility, injustice, sorrow, hurt, and grief. And it helps to recognize that our primary distress is actually coming from the hurt feelings, thoughts, and physical upset we're suffering now, not what hurt us 10 years ago. So the next step is to practice some stress management to soothe the body's fight or flight response. So Fred Luskin, who's the director at Stanford University Forgiveness Project, says the great mistake that people make about forgiveness is that we ask that part of ourselves that's filled with adrenaline, that fight or flight hormone, what to do about a situation. Now, adrenaline is great for lifting a car off a child or something like that, but adrenaline ensures that we have a really narrow ability to think. So when we've been harmed, we lose that sense that the world is a safe, orderly place. And we actually need to recenter. And that could be anything from taking some very deep breaths. You know, we do so much meditation and we're watching the breath. When we slow down the breath and slow down the inhale and really slow down the exhale, it automatically calms our bodies. And there's a lot of different self-care practices that we can do, listening to Dharma Seed, to any one of your favorite Dharma talks, calling a friend, taking a hike in nature, whatever works for you to recenter yourself. And this is all from Fred Luskin at the Forgiveness Center at Stanford. He also says, remember the people or things in your life that you're grateful for, because that starts balancing out your body and your mind, and start savoring them. Remember moments of kindness. Remember feeling cherished and moments of cherishing other people and savoring those feelings throughout the body and letting yourself open to the goodness in humanity and the goodness of yourself. This is the place that forgiveness comes from. So it's actually not from that place. It's impossible to forgive from that place. So that is a signal. You may have been very wronged, but that's a signal to take care of yourself before you make any attempt to try to forgive. States of kindness and compassion and goodwill support us in getting closer to the possibility of forgiving. And once we are in a more balanced state, centered space, then we can open to the pain. It's really impossible to actually forgive if we're not willing to open to the pain. Rumi says, don't reject your fear and loneliness. Let it season you like few ingredients can. So first come the painful thoughts. Again, Fred Luskin at Stanford says, it's not what actually happened. It's how we tell the story. And when the story makes an enemy in any way, it creates a painful, very restricted body, arousing our uptightness. I hate what I did. I hate what you did. I hate what the world did. And when we're devastated, we often milk our stories for the most disturbing parts. So sometimes we make an enemy of someone so we can pin our bad situation on them. Most of our stories are actually reruns, starring me as the victim. And if it's a grudge, it goes back and forth and back and forth, but it really doesn't go anywhere. So it's really important to step back and become aware of the story or the belief and see it as just that. And sometimes that alone will release the pattern. But I know for myself, I like to go on long, quiet retreats, and sometimes some old grudge will come up, and I find myself just embroiled in it. And then what I've trained myself to do is say, okay, Jane, this is going nowhere. You already know where this is, what this story is. You're just replaying it. And then I just force myself to switch. And for me, I just switch to gratitude. I just force myself to tell myself 15 things I'm grateful for right now. And I just keep bringing my mind back to that. And I swear, by the time I'm at the end of 15 things, I can barely remember. I don't want to remember, but I barely can remember that grudge. I mean, I just want to move on because it's not going to go anywhere. It really, it's just a loop that's going round and round. Often the story is that I'm not enough. I'm not smart enough, thin enough, rich enough, young enough, kind enough, spiritual enough. You can go on and on with I'm not enough. And we all have our own versions of that. So I remember I was at a six-week retreat, silent retreat at IMS, and the Dharma teacher asked this group of really serious meditators, experienced people, how many people in the group of 100 meditators judge themselves as not enough. And every hand but one in the group went up. Every single person there was like, I'm not enough. So if you think that you're not enough, you have a lot of company. And it just seems like we demand a perfection of ourselves that we would never ask a friend to. So I have a poem for you that one of my favorite poems that James has read, I'm sure, here before, but it seems very appropriate at this point. It's called Awakening Now by Dana Faulds. Why wait for your awakening? The moment your eyes are open, seize the day. Would you hold back when the beloved beckons? Would you deliver your litany of sins like a child's collection of seashells prized and labeled? No, I can't step across the threshold, you say, eyes downcast. I'm not worthy. I'm afraid. And my motives aren't pure. I'm not perfect, and surely I haven't practiced nearly enough. My meditation isn't deep, and my prayers are sometimes insincere. I still chew my fingernails, and the refrigerator isn't clean. Do you value your reasons for staying small more than the light shining through the open door? Forgive yourself. Now is the only time you have to be whole. Now is the sole moment that exists to live in the light of your true self. Perfection is not a prerequisite for anything but pain. Please, oh please, don't continue to believe in your disbelief. This is the day of your awakening. So Luskin at Stanford also reports that people are unable to forgive because they're not willing to feel the feelings, especially the grief. So I want to lead you through a small meditation by Chris Germer and Kristen Neff, who the creators of Mindful Self-Compassion, which supports people in going deeper to address their feelings below the story. So just bring to mind a mildly painful situation or something that is hard for you to forgive. Don't pick a 10 because it's getting late in the evening and you don't want to go home with it. So pick something mild to moderate, but something you're struggling with. And see if you can first label an emotion. It could be anger or sadness or grief or fear, longing, despair. And if there's more than one, just pick the strongest one and label it. Just say, that's anger. That's fear. Now try to see if there's some place in your body where the feeling expresses itself most strongly. Could be some muscle tension or an achiness. And gently just incline your intention toward the spot, that area of the body, and just see if you can let the muscles kind of soften and relax, just like they would in warm water, just softening. Not really trying to change anything, but just holding the emotions with a tenderness. Now address some soothing thoughts towards yourself. Just feeling some kindness. Perhaps giving some words of kindness to yourself, like, oh, this is hard to feel this. Or something, I'm sorry that I feel this way. May I be kind to myself. I And perhaps just imagining warmth and kindness flowing through your body. You could put your hand on your heart, which would increase the oxytocin in your body, or your hand someplace where you're feeling the pain in your body or the tightness. And just give yourself some warmth and kindness. Just acknowledging to yourself, this is hard to feel this. May I be kind to myself? And just allowing the discomfort to be there, making room for it. You don't really need to make it go away. You're actually just softening to the discomfort, perhaps soothing yourself with a little kindness, and allowing yourself just to feel exactly what you feel. Just accepting that this is the way you feel about this certain situation. And actually, the way out is kindness, anytime, any place. We really need compassion for ourselves and compassion for others. We need to see that we have a story and to try to soften or let it go, even temporarily, just releasing it for a little bit. And understanding that we have feelings in the body connected with our stories. And instead of trying to hope that someone else outside will change, to direct the kindness from ourselves to ourselves because we're suffering. And this might not let completely get rid of the pain. That's not the agenda. We're just allowing the pain to be there. But in a sort of soft and kind way, we can come a little more towards understanding. Understanding what factors led to this. Everyone makes mistakes and does things they shouldn't. Every thought and action is the product of a universe with invisible causes stretching way back through time and outward across the planet. We've inherited our temperament from our parents and our grandparents. Our actions are shaped by so many interacting elements of our environments, our early childhood history, other people in our lives, our diet, our culture, our current events. Actually, we have limited knowledge and control over precisely what we say or what we do from one moment to the next. And the same is true for everyone else. And often we hold a grudge because we're not able to see the bigger picture. James wrote in Awakening Joy that he saw a poster. I was with him actually up at UC. And the picture was of a sad-looking boy with the backdrop for the statistic that a child raised in a home with domestic violence is 700 more times likely to become involved in domestic violence as an adult. So when we recognize that every action has a cause which is part of a long chain of of cause and effect, we can develop more compassion for ourselves and for others. So meditation and awareness help us more fully understand the causes and conditions that are behind our own behaviors and other people's behavior. And they help us replace blame with compassionate understanding. I was a student at UC Berkeley during the 60s, and people romanticized this era. But it was also a hard time. We had grown up believing in democracy, and then all of a sudden we really realized that democracy was not being extended to people of color. We had bus boycotts in the 60s, sit-ins, freedom rides. We had the war in Vietnam going on. We had, at Berkeley, we had a lot of peace marches, activities, stop the drafts, protests. In April 1968, Martin Luther King was assassinated. Then in June 1968, Robert Kennedy was assassinated. Basically, UC Berkeley was the center, or one of the centers for protest. And my professors were basically compassionate activists. And there were many demonstrations going on at all times. And I wanted to become a teacher, and my father would call me and say, please don't get arrested. I'm afraid you won't ever be able to get a teacher's credential if you've gotten arrested. Meanwhile, my boyfriend's father was a public defender, and he would say, oh, Jane, he'd call me Janie in those days, oh, I've already arranged your bail, just go on down, get arrested. So it was crazy making. I wanted to do the right thing, but it was hard. And one particular anti-war demonstration I was involved in turned really ugly. Students filled the streets with bodies, and the police came in, were quite violent, just clubbing people, dragging people by their hair. And my side, the peace side, became really violent in our response. And I didn't want to be arrested in this demonstration. I remember just standing, backing up into the sidelines and just witnessing this and becoming kind of overcome with grief and despair. And it was really years before I heard the Buddhist message that, but I already sort of intuitively got it, that hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is an ancient and internal law. So the next step in the forgiveness process is taking responsibility. That is, if I've caused suffering, rather than wallowing in guilt, it's best to apologize and commit not to do it again. Or to keep out of harm's way if something's been done to me and not allow it to be repeated to me. So one of my professors was both a psychiatrist and an attorney. And he told us a story. We were getting quite disillusioned, and he told us a story about what had happened during World War II, which we were somewhat familiar with, and what happened afterwards. And during World War II, there were over 100,000 Japanese Americans that were taken from their homes shortly after Pearl Harbor was bombed because they were concerned that somehow they might not be as American as they hoped they would be, and that they needed to be rounded up and put in relocation centers. These were centers that were sort of like, they resembled concentration camps, and they were enclosed with barbed wires and patrolled by armed guards, but there were no instruments of genocide. So about two-thirds of the Americans 2/3 of the Japanese Americans were American citizens, and they were forced to live there solely because of their Japanese descent. And I've actually had a number of friends who lived in these camps. My next-door neighbors owned the biggest produce store in Hollywood. And within a short time after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, all that was taken from them, everything. And they just were put in the camp. And also a man that used to be a member of this Sangha, Bob Kaneko, was also, his family, he was like very young, and his family lived in Berkeley, and they were afraid, so they went camping for 8 months, and then finally got sent to the detention camps and lived out the war there. So I've known other people, and they've unanimously said that was a tough place to grow up. Now, actually, the person who gave the orders was President Franklin Roosevelt. And the person who carried out the war orders was the California Governor Earl Warren. And yet, years later, Warren said he deeply regretted his actions of carrying out the removal order because he later realized it was not in keeping with our American concept of freedom and the rights of citizens. As a father of six and a devoted family man, his guilt was very personal. Whenever I thought of those innocent little children who were torn from home, school friends, and congenial surroundings, I was conscience-stricken. On reflection, Warren believed that it was wrong to react so impulsively without any positive evidence of disloyalty. So Earl Warren had to come to terms with his own racial and ethnic stereotyping, which had led him to cause such damaging action. And years later, Earl Warren had the opportunity to take an entirely different course of action, which would positively affect millions of lives. And that was in 1954, as the Supreme Court Justice, Warren wrote the court's unanimous decision, Brown versus Board of Education, that racial segregation in public schools was based on stereotypes that were unfair, unequal, and offensive to American life. So he emphatically stated that segregation failed to provide black and white children equal protection under law, a protection guaranteed by the 14th Amendment, and segregation was therefore deemed unconstitutional. So I bring up this story, which our professor told us because he worked on that case to raise all the evidence, because people do have a chance to redeem themselves. It is not too late when you realize that you have done something that you feel it was not appropriate. It's not too late to change and do something to make amends. And from the Buddhist scriptures, the Dharmapada says, people who recognize their mistakes and change their ways illuminate the world like the moon when freed from a cloud. So finally, my final words are, just remember that a life well lived is the best way to get out of the prison of your mind. And life's so much more, it's so much bigger and more open than the stories that keep us stuck and the grudges that keep going. So instead of focusing on our wounded feelings, it's about also learning to look for the love, the beauty, the kindness around you, and to work for justice without letting the grudge get in the way. So forgiveness is really about claiming our own personal power to offer a balanced, kind, creative response to the world. So, that's it for me. Any questions? Questions or comments? Let's see. I think so. Yeah, I think we're supposed to...
Very early in the talk, you said something about little frustrations of the day, little frustrations that come up. Could you work through those that a little bit as to how to work with that?
Okay. Well, it's just that research shows it's easier to get some things going if we practice little and often. And by little, it's like don't wait till someone's done the hit and run job on your car or something. Practice on the, you know, just... someone did something small that you don't like, and practice letting go of, you know, doesn't mean you have to be best friends with them, but you can let go of the turmoil that's keeping you going. Does that make sense? Okay. Anybody else? Come, oh, over here. Yeah.
Hi. You had mentioned an experience being at a retreat and kind of circling through a narrative in your head and then finally kind of putting your foot down and like ending the narrative. I was just wondering... How exactly you did that in your mind, like when you knew like enough was enough and kind of got firm with yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, okay. I just know some of my own stories. They just come up and they're really, there's just, what's the point, you know? I mean, there's just no new news. You know, it's just rumination, we call it often, or whatever. And the person might be in Hawaii having a great time, you know. I mean, they're not suffering. I'm the one that's going around and around with it. And I don't really want to spend the retreat doing that. So it's not like it's some kind of great insight that's going to help me. This rumination, it's like I've heard this before and I don't think there's any reason to cultivate it. So for me, I just say, okay. And for me, distraction helps. So, and I like gratitude. I've actually had a gratitude email practice with a friend for years and years where we would used to email each other a couple things that we were truly grateful for during the day. So I had built up that practice. But I think it's a great practice, and I think at some point, if you see your mind is just on a loop, criticizing yourself or other people, it's time to change, you know? It's time to drop it. And to me, to replace it by genuinely looking around for what's good. And when I'm on a retreat, it's usually a great setting, and you know, there's all these other people that are devoted to being more conscious and caring and finding and wise. So there's not a shortage of things to be grateful for. It's just that I consciously choose to have a different mental movie going on. Does that explain it?
Oh, thank you, Jane. I really enjoyed your talk. I got a lot out of it. And I particularly like the reminder and the emphasis that it's really a self-love, forgiveness. It's really about caring for ourselves because we really can't forgive someone else because they're not, you know, they haven't really done anything. It's what we're doing to ourselves.
Yeah.
In a way. Yeah. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for being here. Kay and I are old friends, so I appreciate her being here. Anyone else? So for all those beings and for all of us and for certainly all the beings in the world who are suffering, for all of us, may we be happy. May we be peaceful. May we be as healthy as possible. May we be kind to ourselves and others. May we learn to let go with grace and dignity. May we be generous. May we know our own good fortune and share that with others. And may any kindness, goodness, wisdom, compassion developed tonight be shared with all beings.